This week on Q&A, West Point English professor Elizabeth Sammet discusses her annotated edition of Ulysses S. Grant's memoirs.
Elizabeth Sammet, you have a book that's over 1,000 pages long called The Annotated Memoir of Ulysses S. Grant. What's different about this book than all the other Grant books?
Well, the subject of Grant is obviously well written about by so many people, mostly by historians for obvious reasons. I'm a professor of literature, and so my primary interest really was in his language, in the way he represents his war experience especially. And I wanted to try to situate the book in its literary and cultural context in the 19th century, and also in a sort of longer term, longer horizon, to think about it in the spectrum of war writing from antiquity really to the present day, and how challenging it is to represent war in language, and how Grant really does rise to the occasion in that respect.
You teach English literature to what group?
I teach English to cadets at the United States Military Academy at West Point, and I teach everything from our first-year cadets, known as plebes, to the upper-class cadets who are sometimes English majors. We have a full range of undergraduate majors, including English literature.
Is there any way to describe the difference between teaching to a cadet that's at West Point and a student in a normal university?
I think in many ways there are many similarities, the subject matter, for example, but my students have a very particular idea of what they'll be doing after graduation, and so our study of literature has a context, a shared context, that I think might not be the case at other institutions.
How did you go to West Point?
Actually, the part of that answer is Grant. I was in graduate school and ended
Where?
Up reading at Yale, reading the memoirs, and I can't even tell anymore how I came to them, but there I was reading them when I was supposed to be writing my dissertation, and they surprised me immensely and introduced me to West Point, where he was an ambivalent cadet, and I found myself really attracted by his story and surprised by it, and then soon after that the opportunity came up to teach there, so it was a happy coincidence.
What surprised you about the memoirs?
I expected, from my limited acquaintance with 19th century memoirs, a more florid, ornate approach to writing, but also a more romantic, heroic, glorified account of war. And his account is the antithesis of all of that. It's lean and spare in terms of the language itself, and it is, he regarded war as a business which he was trained to do, but he never reveled in it, and he never took delight or any relish in the activity.
What's the period of time that these memoirs cover?
So the memoirs cover, in this way, they're a conventional 19th century autobiography in that they begin with his youth, his boyhood. Doesn't spend much time on that. Spends a great deal of time on the Mexican War. Some of the most interesting moments for me occur during the treatment of the Mexican War. And then he goes all the way up through the end of the Civil War and stops there.
What do you think of him?
I admire him. I admire him because he's fallible and because he often, though not always, but often in the memoirs will own up to that, will own up to failures, is willing to tell a joke on himself. I think in that he shared something with Lincoln in his sense of humor and his self-deprecation. And he was always willing to suggest that he had learned something or figured something out along the way.
One of the biggest surprises in the memoir isn't the memoir, it's a note on the flap of the book's cover. There is so much there. A tanner's son, failing at so much, turned savior of his country, a slaveholder turned mass emancipator, the warrior transformed into a warrior poet, the words of Ta-Nehisi Coates.
Yes, Ta-Nehisi Coates is a big Grant fan, and I think he captures quite beautifully. He did a wonderful series of blogs for The Atlantic on his experience of reading the memoirs. And I think that he found in Grant someone who has deep flaws but also great virtues, and who did rise from modest circumstances to become a great savior of the Union, and as Coates suggests, a mass emancipator serving that cause.
Where did you grow up?
I grew up in Boston.
Anybody in your family in the military?
My father was in the Army Air Corps in World War II.
Did you ever talk to him about that?
I did. I talked to him a lot about his war, about his army, which was very different, of course, from today's army. And I think, like many members of his generation, he always downplayed those experiences. And he was perfectly willing to talk to me about them. He served much of the war as an air traffic controller in India.
When you teach at West Point, how often do you have to be in the classroom?
I think we're in the classroom. It's probably comparable to most civilian institutions. So, you know, teach a few courses each semester and then meeting with students individually as well.
If I walked into your classroom, what would I most likely hear you talking about?
You'd most likely hear me talking about probably a specific passage in a work. I love to dig right in with poetry or prose to the text itself and to look at the evidence and see what it has to tell us before we jump to conclusions.
Do they read the memoirs?
They do. In fact, I'm teaching, I've always taught various excerpts for a variety of reasons, but this year I'm teaching our war literature elective, and we're focusing on the Civil War, and so Grant's memoirs will be a big part of it.
So many people have come to this chair right here and talked about U.S. Grant, and I want to show you a little bit of video of some of them and ask you why, how so many books have been written and whether or not they ever sell. Here's one of the most recent ones, Ron Chernow.
What he got into the habit of doing, kind of with great courage and fortitude, was that he would go for 4 or 5 hours at a stretch without eating or drinking anything. And that was really not simply to avoid the pain of the swallowing, but I think even more importantly, not to have to take any painkillers that might interfere with his mental clarity. So I don't know that any book, particularly any masterpiece like this, has ever been composed under such horrific circumstances. And, you know, it's a masterpiece. Even Mark Twain said its style is flawless, no man can improve upon it. And Twain thought it was such a great military memoir that deserved to stand alongside Caesar's commentaries. And many commentators and readers since then have agreed.
What would you add to that?
Well, I would suggest that that the story of the memoir's composition is part of what lends this book its great power for me. So I would agree with that. The pain that Grant suffered, the way that he had to conserve his energy. The Library of Congress, in addition to having the manuscript, has a collection of many of the notes that Grant would write, because it was so painful to speak, that he would write to his doctor. And I had the really moving experience of reading the manuscript alongside those notes. And what you see there is the dissolution of his physical body and this desperate clinging to all the energy, the reserves of energy he has left, and an iron determination to give all of every last ounce of strength to the memoirs, to the completing of this book. Because, of course, he doesn't want to write his memoirs initially, but is compelled to by a few calamitous circumstances in the last few years of his life, including bankruptcy and this diagnosis of his fatal cancer.
I don't know whether you tracked it or not, but do you know how many exact days there are after he finished this to when he died?
It's only a few days, I think less than a week, when he's doing the last correcting proofs and things like that until he dies. And he's up at a cottage in Mount McGregor near Saratoga, New York, and asks to be. You can still go up there. It's relatively unspoiled. Not a lot of people visit it, and you can see the circumstances in which he wrote it, and the same room and the chair in which he sat, and you can get a sense of the whole atmosphere there when he was working on it.
Back in 2016, Ronald White also did a book on U.S. Grant, and he was here, and here's just a little bit of what he had to say.
Grant puts us right into the story as if maybe Lee could win, maybe he would win. He masters the idea of writing with action verbs. He eschews adjectives and adverbs. And John Russell Young, who was traveling with him as a correspondent for a New York newspaper, elicits from Grant all kinds of personal reminiscences about the key figures of the era, Abraham Lincoln, George McClellan, Robert E. Lee. These become then part of the memoir, where Grant gives his own thumbnail sketches of why Abraham Lincoln, in his words, is the greatest figure of this whole era. And so it's just memorable to read this. It's very clear, spare English language. Lincoln said he liked the Saxon language, sturdy one-syllable words. Grant writes in the very same way.
Did you read his book?
Yes, I've read his biography.
Did you read Ron Chernow's book?
Yes.
So is there any difference between these books?
I think Ron White's book is really interesting on a lot of different elements, especially Grant's youth and his Methodism and a variety of attributes. I think Ron Chernow emphasizes a couple of things. I think he emphasizes the presidency and the various strides that the administration made on behalf of civil rights for African Americans, all of which, sadly, of course, are erased in the Compromise of 1877. But he also makes, Ron Chernow's book also makes much of Grant's alcoholism, as he calls it. And I think Chernow wants to change the way we think about Grant's relationship with alcohol, instead of looking at it as a moral failing, as it would have been regarded in the 19th century, to look at it more as an addiction. I think Grant, when he was alone in the West, away from his family, in between the Mexican and Civil Wars, did probably drink to excess, and that the circumstances surrounding his resignation from the Army are mysterious, but that's really where the rumors start about his drinking. But I think I resist the temptation to make Grant's relationship or struggle with alcohol the main narrative of his life.
This is called an annotated memoir. What does that mean?
So it's full of my own annotations and illustrations throughout the work, and those are the moments where I try to read Grant's prose, Grant's descriptions in parallel with descriptions of similar or the same episodes by his contemporaries, or descriptions, let's say, of a siege or of an attack, comparing those Grant's descriptions with those that come from other periods, everything from Caesar. Ron Chernow mentioned the connection that Twain makes between Caesar's commentaries and Grant's memoirs. So I will put Caesar in there and Caesar's description of various activities connected to war and then Grant's.
Twain was the publisher of the book.
Yes.
How did you... What was the time when you said, I got to do this? Or who said this to you, Elizabeth Samet, you've got to do this annotated version?
So fortunately, my editor said, would you like to do this? And I said, absolutely. I think that would be a great idea. And it sort of, I realized at the time that I had been in my own way unwittingly preparing it since graduate school when the book became so important to me. And so it was really a kind of dream come true to be able to spend so much time with this book that had in many ways shaped my ideas of 19th century America, my ideas of military culture, and various attitudes. A lot of that comes through Grant for me.
When did you start?
I guess I sort of poured on most of the work in the last two or three years.
You mean so, it only took two or three years to do what you did here?
Yeah, I mean, it was in a sense sort of organizing thinking that I had been doing for a long time, but it was a pretty intensive period of work. Yeah.
What's the most fun part of this for you?
That's a difficult question to answer in that there were so many parts that I enjoyed. One of the parts that I enjoyed the most was going to battlefields and being able to bring the book along and see the terrain. One of Grant's, I think, great strengths as a commander was his amazing ability to understand terrain and topography. And so he writes about it with an ease and with a great clarity. But to be there once, I don't share that necessarily, that automatic understanding of terrain. And so to be able to go to Shiloh, for example, and to be able to understand the topography that he's describing in the book was really a great treat for me. And one of the other elements that I greatly enjoyed is connected with that was photography, was being able to through photography, another way of making sense of the war and making sense of the way we remember it.
And there's a lot of your photography in the book.
Yes, I was fortunately able to include that, as well as images from the West Point Archives and from the Library of Congress and other places.
What would you say to someone who doesn't really care about the Civil War? And you know you find these people who
right.
say, you get somebody right. that's totally for it, and somebody else said, I don't care about the Civil War.
Right.
When you talk about Shiloh, where is it and what happened there?
So Shiloh is in Tennessee, and it was the first major battle in the Western Theater. The Western Theater of the Civil War is, I think, largely neglected in favor of the Eastern Theater and the battles in Virginia. And Shiloh has it's a two-day battle. It has a tremendous number of casualties. And I think that like Antietam, which is probably a more well-known battle in the East, it really changes the way many people think about the war. I think a lot of soldiers and civilians had thought the Civil War would be over in a matter of months. Shiloh confirms for Grant in particular that they would have to win the war by complete conquest, that this was an all-or-nothing venture.
So that was 1862?
Right.
How long did you spend there when you went to visit?
I spent a nice day at Shiloh, and then looked around at Corinth and northern Mississippi as well, which is where there still is an important railroad junction, and there was the site of a battle and a siege in the war as well. It took about a month for the Union troops to make it down to Corinth, and it's actually an interesting story, which Grant writes about. By the time they get to Corinth, Grant had been, even though he won the Battle of Shiloh, he had been criticized heavily for not being prepared and for being surprised. The troops had not entrenched, and Sherman, who was on the battlefield when the Confederates attacked, didn't seem prepared for it. Grant, whose headquarters were several miles away, made it down to the battle. And so there was some controversy there, controversy that actually raged throughout the rest of the 19th century. I think that battle is as much written about by the participants as any other. And so when Henry Halleck arrived on the scene to take command, he sort of pushed Grant off to the side and made him second in command. And Grant essentially had not much to do. So the army took about a month to make its way to Corinth. And Halleck and others were convinced that the Confederates were actually reinforcing Corinth, when in fact they were evacuating. And Grant has a wonderful passage in there where he says that many of the troops, his troops, had been railroad men in civilian life, and they used to put their ears to the rail, and they could tell which trains were full and which were empty. And the railroad men said, the heavy trains are leaving, and the empty trains are coming back. But the Confederates threw a ruse, cheering incoming trains, actually ended up fooling the Union troops.
I remember this statistic. Help me out here. Was it Shiloh? There were 2,000 horses buried? Was it there, or was that just...
There were many, and I'm not sure of the exact number, but there were so many that when Sherman writes home about the battle afterwards, he spends time telling his wife, actually, that the number of horses on the battlefield is astronomical, and it's a shocking sight. Throughout the war, the number of horses and mules to be burned or buried was really incredible.
Here's, I think the first person I interviewed here on Grant was Jeffrey Perret back in 1997. And I want to run a clip where he talks about Grant's role in the Civil War and see if you agree or disagree.
No Grant, and there is no victory in the Civil War for the Union. The Civil War would have probably ended in a stalemate with a negotiated peace rather than a surrender. Now, what kind of peace that would be, I don't know. But I believe that Grant was the only general who could coordinate the Union's strengths and bring them to bear on the Confederacy in time to ensure Lincoln's reelection in 1864.
What would Abraham Lincoln say was Grant's biggest strength?
I think, well, he said it's a version of it several times, was that he had a tenacity and a will to keep going where other generals would have been daunted. The other strength I think he had, Lincoln would have recognized this, was that Grant understood the political context of war fighting. And I'm not sure that all of his contemporaries did. So he understood sometimes that the timing of victories, he understood the need for what was called the political general, the general who was an appointee, who could bring in votes, which was particularly important, and could also recruit effectively, but may have had some political, there were a few political generals, John Logan was one of them, who actually turned out to be good commanders in the field, but many were not, and it was a sort of inconvenience that Grant and other professionals had to put up with. But he understood the reasons for it, and he understood that Lincoln's war aims had a great deal to do with tactics and operations and strategy, that they were all of a piece.
You talk about two historians, Lloyd Lewis and Bruce Catton.
Yes.
And you talk about revisionism of Grant. When was he at his lowest? And I know in our surveys, we've done three surveys on presidents, he's gone from 33 up to 22, I believe, over a period of about 10 years. But when was he at his lowest, and why has there been a revision?
So he, but something we tend to forget is that at the time he died in 1885, he was the most famous American in the world, probably. He had achieved a kind of celebrity probably even greater than Lincoln's. And in his world tour that he took after his presidency, he went all the way to Japan and was greeted everywhere he went as a great hero. And then soon after his death, his death and his funeral, in which there were two Confederate and two Union pallbearers, former Confederate and Union pallbearers, was a sort of great moment of national reconciliation. And unfortunately, that drive toward reconciliation, coming on the heels of the end of Reconstruction, was achieved at the expense of African Americans. And Frederick Douglass, in a speech several years before Grant's death, talks about peace among the whites and what that would mean for the country. And what it ended up meaning was the rise of Jim Crow in the South and rolling back all of the advances made during the war and in the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments for African-American civil rights. And the engines of what we think of as a lost cause nostalgia really got into gear during the 1890s and throughout the early part of the 20th century, culminating, I think, in the 50th reunion at Gettysburg in 1913, where Woodrow Wilson, who was the first president from the South after the Civil War and who introduced segregation into Washington, D.C., into the federal workforce, in his History of the American People, espoused this similar sort of idea about Reconstruction, that it was a tyrannical regime imposed on the South and that the South had sort of liberated itself from this yoke. And Grant was a casualty of that lost cause nostalgia, which really dominated much of the century. And then Lewis and Catton, working in the middle of the century, really began, I think, a resurgence that's continued ever since as we've continued to reevaluate the war and reevaluate our own attitudes toward memorialization and commemoration.
Can you explain more about lost cause? In my reading, and I'm no expert on any of this, but my reading, that phrase has come up more and more in recent years.
Right. The Southern cause was romanticized, and these engines of memorial engines really started revving up, I think, almost before the war ended. But there were many people, including former Confederate officers like Jubal Early in their memoirs and several publications and journals, organizations like the United Daughters of the Confederacy, who worked earnestly to burnish this lost cause. And so as a result, the submerging of slavery and the rise of this idea of states' rights, sort of the decoupling of the cause of the Confederacy from slavery, and the cultivation of something we might, that some have called the plantation myth, that in fact the antebellum South was a really peaceful, tranquil place, and that you know, everyone was really better off at that time. And so this idea, this nostalgic lament, this deeply romantic version of Southern culture, which really triumphed, I think, and there was nothing in the Northern literature really that counteracted it. And so, you know, if the the historian Eric Foner said this, I'm paraphrasing, but the North won the war, but the South really won the memory, the war over the memory of the war.
What do you think about the fact that the Grant Museum is at Mississippi State?
Yes.
Run by John Marszalek, who wrote an annotated version of this 2 years ago.
Right.
And I wanted to ask you about that. What's the difference between what John Marszalek did and your book to start with? But what do you think of the fact that the Grant Museum is at Mississippi State University?
Right. Well, I think that the library, it couldn't be in better hands than John's. I spent a wonderful week down there doing research. And I do think it's just sort of an accident of circumstance that's where he is, that's where he taught, and so the library ended up there. And I think it's actually quite nice in a sense and fitting, and maybe a strange initially, but perhaps ultimately appropriate idea that the preservation of Grant's legacy can happen in the Deep South. His book, the annotated memoirs that he came out with a few years ago, is the sort of crowning jewel in the papers of Ulysses S. Grant, which was started by John Y. Simon. And I think the memoirs had been conspicuously absent from that collection. And so now that's in place as well. And so John, as a historian, and his team of historians really, I think, emphasize and help us to understand a lot of the historical and military historical context.
If I had his book and your book, what would be the substantive difference in the two?
I think that his book offers great, whenever, for example, Grant offers a casualty number or mentions a figure, John will have the exact casualty number and where to find it, and the sort of fact-checking of Grant and the illumination of every figure has a wonderful little biography that will tell us, you know, who that figure is. My book, I think they complement each other in a lot of ways, in that while I'm, of course, interested in and attempt to be scrupulous in matters historical, I don't chase down every statistic. I do preface it with saying that Grant is not always correct about certain things. I'm more interested in the way that he remembers it, and the way that he chooses to represent war. So I will often delve into those moments where he doesn't describe something. What Grant fails to mention here is some aspect of the conflict. So, for example, when he talks about casualties on a battlefield, I will often pair those moments with a detailed description, for example, of field hospitals from physicians of the time, from surgeons of the time, or accounts of those from a contemporary novelist. So the novelist John William DeForest, for example, who has a book, a novel based on his own war service, has a detailed description of a scene in a field hospital. Grant doesn't offer that, so I want to sort of use those moments in 19th century literature as a kind of complement to flesh out the book.
I once asked John Y. Simon, who's deceased since 2008, what he didn't like about Grant, and he was responsible for the Grant papers in the very beginning, and he, in a different way, at a different time, pointed this out. We're going to run some videos so you can see what he said and give us the background on this.
It's absolutely true that in December 1862, Grant issued orders expelling the Jews as a class, that's the way he put it, it was inaccurate, from the Department of the Tennessee. That doesn't mean the state of Tennessee. That means the entire department that stretches from occupied areas in Mississippi all the way up through Kentucky into Paducah. And it was an act of extreme prejudice and extreme ignorance, of which Grant in time came to be deeply ashamed. So ashamed that he doesn't mention it in his memoirs and doesn't speak of it later on.
Your take on that?
I think John Simon's absolutely right. It is Julia Dent in her memoirs does mention it briefly, and she calls it an obnoxious order. And
that's
it
his
was.
Wife.
Yes,
yeah.
Yes. And he ought to have been ashamed of it, and he was. And, of course, Lincoln immediately rescinded it. That is a conspicuous absence from the memoirs. He does not retread that. But he did spend the rest of his life in various contexts trying to atone for it, and I think he was rightly deeply ashamed.
When you did your research for this, where's the best research that you did?
I would say there are a variety of places. So the library at Mississippi State, the Library of Congress, West Point has, fortunately, some really fascinating documents relating to, particularly to Grant's time as a cadet, but also some letters and other things from later on. And the other thing that the West Point Special Collections offers is the personal, some of the letters and papers of Grant's contemporaries. So you find things from Sherman, you find things from George Crook, you find all sorts of records, and you can see the way, what it reinforced for me was the how intimate their relationships were, and everyone knew everyone. Grant will often mention in his memoirs, oh, yes, I knew so-and-so at West Point, or I fought with so-and-so in the Mexican War. And it's his way of suggesting that he knew how someone's mind worked, he knew how that person would respond in a difficult situation, in an emergency.
You've got pictures in here of the monument in New York City, and I heard you in another time tell the story about a woman that you overheard standing there. You know what I'm talking about?
Yes. I often make a pilgrimage up to Grant's tomb, which isn't too far from where I live. And it's visited, but it's not. It used to be the most popular landmark in New York City. That was early in the 20th century. And there was a time several decades ago now, I guess, where it had really fallen into disrepair. And it's since been fixed up and looking much better. But I'm not sure that everybody knows what they're looking for when they go to see it. And so I did overhear someone, a tourist, say to her companion, I didn't even know we had a president named Grant.
What was your reaction when you heard that?
Well, I sort of laughed. I didn't intervene, but I did laugh. And it struck me because I think, for me, I mean, obviously, I'm interested in Grant as president, and that presidency was puzzling and troubling in many ways. But when I think of him, I think of him first as a writer, because that's how I first encountered him, not as a general, not as a president, but as someone who was writing about all of these experiences. And
had he written anything other than this memoir?
Well, of course, you can read his wartime dispatches and letters, and I had read some of those from earlier in his life. And then he did write, near the end of his life, a few articles for the Century magazine, the first one on Shiloh, and that was how the Century magazine actually first encouraged him to write his memoirs. And it was when Mark Twain saw the deal the Century was giving him that he said, no, I can do much better for you.
I bring this up for obvious reasons. You'll see this is a quote you have from Gore Vidal, that Ulysses S. Grant's memoir was the best American prose, proof that genius is innate since West Point's English department in his day, and he went there, did not dazzle. West Point's English department now not only did not dazzle, it did not exist in Grant's day. It was established in the 1920s.
Right.
What's the English department like now at West Point?
The English department now, I think, is rather like English departments elsewhere. We teach several courses. We teach two courses in our core curriculum, a composition and a literature course. We also teach philosophy in our department, so it is now a department of English and philosophy. And then we have English and philosophy majors.
You write a quote often from William T. Sherman, William Tecumseh Sherman.
Yes.
What was his relationship, personal relationship with Grant?
So he and Grant first encountered one another at West Point, although Sherman was senior to Grant. And they became reacquainted during the Civil War. And it was, I think, for both men, it was the most important professional relationship of their lives. And it was characterized by a great deal of trust. They had disagreements on occasion. In fact, at Vicksburg, when Grant decided on his strategy of running the batteries below the fortress at Vicksburg and coming up from the south, cutting loose from his base of supply, Sherman cautioned him against it. He was opposed to this and wrote him a note saying this. And of course, that strategy of cutting loose from supplies is something that Sherman took to an extreme in his march through the South later on in the war. But they had the kind of relationship where Sherman felt that he could register his disagreement. And I think that's actually, in many ways, a sign of true loyalty, is that you're willing to register your disagreement, and then when that complaint has been lodged and the decision has been made, then to carry it out, which Sherman did.
This is in odd quotes and all that from the book, and I'll get your reaction to this. Is from what Grant wrote: "The conceit was knocked out of me by two little circumstances that happened soon after the arrival of the clothes, which gave me a distaste for military uniform that I've never recovered from."
Right.
What's the background on that?
So he's often pictured in the Civil War wearing just sort of a regular coat with the general's straps, as he called them, the insignia, the shoulder straps. He really didn't like grand uniforms. And he tells that story in his youth of getting that first uniform and being mocked by people at home. And his other model in this was Zachary Taylor, whom he encountered in the Mexican War. He actually served two generals in the Mexican War, Taylor and Winfield Scott. And those two generals' nicknames, Old Rough and Ready for Taylor and Old Fuss and Feathers for Scott, I think in many ways emblematizes their difference. Scott used to like to wear all the uniform, Grant says, that regulation allowed. Taylor was often seen in civilian clothes and a farmer's hat to protect him from the sun, sitting sideways on his horse casually watching the battle. And Scott was always dressed to the nines. And I think that Grant took Taylor as a model in that. And also he took Taylor as a model in his prose. He said that Taylor wrote orders in language so plain there could be no mistaking it. And that's his own.
As you know, Abraham Lincoln was a private or whatever in the Mexican War.
Right.
Did Lincoln and Grant ever cross paths in the Mexican War?
No.
And what years were those?
Lincoln was in the Blackfoot War, as it was called, I think. And then his involvement in the Mexican War, actually, by that time,
he was a congressman. Yeah, he was against it.
Yeah, and spoke out against it and was ridiculed as a result. And so I'm not even sure at the time that they would have known each other. But Lincoln's own account of his war service he says that is a very self-deprecating moment about his very unheroic war service.
Here's an example of how you use literature, and these are your words. Grant's playful, rather literary vignette calls to mind a moment in Charles Dickens' Great Expectations. What were you doing there? What's that story?
So Great Expectations was actually in my mind because I've several times, when I was working on this, because I teach it to the cadets, and it was serialized and then published in the 1860s, and you can actually see cadets at the time, we have the library registers, checking it out from the library and reading it. And so I sort of associate it with that time period. And there is a moment there in Great Expectations where Pip, who is the son, he's apprenticed to a blacksmith and has very sort of modest expectations until he gets an unknown benefactor. And one of the first things that happens is he gets a new suit of clothes. And he parades through town in his new suit of clothes and is mocked mercilessly by a young boy in the town. And that reminded me very much of that scene where Grant himself is mocked by someone in town when he's wearing his brand new uniform.
When you teach the plebes at West Point, when do you notice that they get really interested in what you're talking about?
Well, the wonderful thing about plebes is that they're interested day one, that they have been plunged into a rather new world and a new culture, and they're full of curiosity about it. And they have an energy and a real curiosity. And I think that if you have a passion for your subject matter, no matter what it is, they respond in kind.
You started teaching at the Academy what year?
In 1997.
So you've known some of these young men that went to war?
Yes. Men and women who have went to war, who have gone to war and come home. Some of them have gone to war repeatedly. One of my former students, who's now a major, referred to his life for several years there as a war commuter, that he sort of, it became normal to come, to go back and forth, in his case, to Afghanistan several times.
You have a footnote on page 328. Grant expresses his frustration with reporters on several occasions in the memoirs. Franker still, in his correspondence, he was often frustrated and personally wounded by the false stories that circulated in newspapers about his incompetence and, worse yet, his drinking.
Yes, he was very frustrated with the press. In fact, he did praise the Confederacy for this, for their treatment of the press. He said, in a sense, that they had complete control over the press, and he was not particularly happy with the rather freewheeling reporters who arrived in camp and told various stories and rumors. He knew very well the damage that rumors could do to the morale of an army, and so I think that was a particular frustration. But yes, he was often, and does not have a particularly progressive attitude toward reporters or the press, and I think was particularly frustrated with the tall, what he regarded as tall tales, or even just criticism that the press would render.
Another footnote, you quote John Keegan, who's deceased also, but a war historian, argues that Grant had a particular aptitude for the telegraph. And then later on, you say the service's first historian, William Plum, who was an operator in the Western Theater, writes, "Thus organized, the United States military telegraph became the medium of communications by which hundreds of thousands of armed men were directed from point to point, commissary, subsistence, and ordnance stores ordered, and the innumerable necessities of great armies made known, as well as the story of their victories and defeats." How important was that telegraph?
I think many people recognize that one of Grant's great strengths was in figuring out how to use the technology of the day, and the telegraph and the railroad being the two greatest examples of that. And I think it was hugely important in being able to communicate, in being able to transport, obviously, with great dispatch, large numbers of supplies as well as troops. And I think Grant adapted quite well to those technologies and used the telegraph quite frequently. Of course, there were also times, telegraph notwithstanding, that he lost, for example, complete contact with Sherman and just trusted that Sherman was going about his business in Georgia, which of course, he was. And so those technologies had limitations, too, and they still had to use scouts and couriers.
You have 70 chapters and a conclusion and an introduction and an editor's note.
Right.
Did you ever count up the number of footnotes you have?
I did not count the number of footnotes. So, yeah, I can't answer you on that.
So, I mean, if someone hasn't seen your book, it
right.
has the memoirs of Grant, and then
right.
below that on pages you have your explanations.
Yes.
How did you keep track of all that?
Well, one of the wonderful aspects about the book was this, the quality of design, and that I was more involved in that than I had been in previous projects because of the illustrations as well. So there was a great challenge sometimes in figuring out, when I was reading around in different memoirs or different pieces from the period, what would be the best place for a fantastic description of this or that. And so it did occasion a lot of reshuffling and a lot and moving things around to find just the right moment to illustrate a particular aspect of war, or also to illustrate what was happening to civilians at the time, because I think we tend to forget, that's another reason I liked going to battlefields, was that we tend to forget that people were trying to carry on, farmers and people were living their lives while armies marched through their towns and their fields. And that's easily forgotten, I think. So sometimes using diaries, particularly, for example, during the Siege of Vicksburg, using diaries from civilians who were trapped in the city at the time offered a counterpoint to Grant's description of all of the siege operations along his lines.
You have a full page on page 691 about casualties, and it starts out with, "Historians estimate a total of 195,000 Union and 215,000 Confederate prisoners of war, approximately 15.5% of the former and 12% of the latter, died." And then later on, you quote from the Sanitary Commission's 1864 report on famine. What was that?
So I'm not sure exactly which.
Well, let me read to you what you quote. It was about the middle of last autumn that this process of slow starvation became intolerable, injurious, and cruel. The cornbread began to be the roughest and coarsest description. Portions of the cob and husk were often found ground in with the meal. I'll jump ahead. The peas were often full of worms or maggots in the chrysalis state? Is that the way you pronounce it? And which, when they made soup, floated on the surface. What were you trying to do?
So I believe that's the description of conditions in Libby prison in Richmond.
Correct.
Yeah. So the Sanitary Commission, an organization of volunteers, was trying to detail the various privations in southern in prisoner of war camps. The treatment of southern prisoners in northern camps, particularly in New York State, was also quite brutal, and the conditions freezing. To be a prisoner of war during any conflict is a horrible thing. In this conflict, it often entailed those kinds of hardships, that the food and the conditions were terrible, and Libby was particularly bad in that respect, as was Andersonville prison.
Did you go to either prison?
So I have not visited those sites.
Have historians done on capturing the Civil War, and how well did the government do at the time keeping records?
The Civil War, in particular, the number of casualties generated, I think caused the War Department actually to keep records in a much more regular fashion. So the War Department afterwards has the official records, as it's called, of the War of the Rebellion, and multi-volume compendium of Northern and Southern war correspondence and dispatches and orders, and was an amazing record-keeping project. And I think the sheer numbers of people involved made the War Department realize that record-keeping was a vital aspect of this, and the idea that it could tell and preserve the history of the war in these records.
I just noticed in one of the footnotes the name Brooke Simpson, and Brooke Simpson was here in the year 2000 talking about Grant. Here is something that he had to say about the general.
And I think he's an extremely able commander who was able to master challenges that felled other men. His success was not inevitable by any means, that he was a master at improvising, responding on the spur of the moment to changes in plan and changes in circumstances. I think he did that well. I think, on the other hand, he played favorites and sometimes was a little too stubborn in adhering to those favorites and not taking a second look at some people he did not like. Sometimes he was so interested in offensive action that he forgot that the enemy also had a will and might try to impose it upon him. So I think there were things that Grant did that weren't so shrewd.
Yeah, I think the point about Grant's aggressiveness is right on the mark, in that his errors were those of being too aggressive. He has a moment early when he's first in command in the Civil War, and he's chasing a Confederate commander named Harris through Missouri. And he has this incident, and he comes up on Harris's camp that had just been vacated, and he said that he realized the enemy was as afraid of him as he was of the enemy, and he calls that a valuable lesson. But I think sometimes he didn't always remember certain precautions, and I think sometimes those errors of aggression didn't yield great results. But I think on the whole, he was keen to make decisions, and was extremely frustrated by commanders and impatient with commanders who took a long time, who delayed, who wouldn't act. That was his great frustration with various commanders.
As you know, William McFeely had a book, and we don't. He's not been here, but we don't have any excerpts from him. And there are lots of others. Have these books sold?
I think so. I mean, I think certainly the most recent books, I mean, those are, I guess, have been much in the news of late, I think have sold very well. And, of course, McFeely's book won a Pulitzer Prize. And I think that Civil War history There are always enthusiasts who want to read the latest take on a given figure, particularly figures who have undergone revision, like Grant himself.
The same footnote that has Brooks Simpson's reference in it, it starts out this way. Perhaps more than any other engagement, the assault at Cold Harbor gave Grant a reputation as a butcher. Why?
Well, the assault at Cold Harbor, unfortunately, the Confederates had already had time to entrench, and this assault was ordered, and the casualties were devastating. And I have some accounts in there of the cries of the wounded and the sheer number of casualties. And that and one of the attacks at Vicksburg are the two things that Grant says he regrets the most. He also regretted the attack, the explosion of the crater at Petersburg. And this is a moment, Brooke Simpson, in that segment you played, talked about some of Grant's errors as a commander. I think in some of those instances, because he was very willing to delegate and did not want to spend a lot of his time worrying about matters that his subordinates could do, and I think as a result freed himself up to think about strategic issues, sometimes he didn't intervene when he should have, and I think he let the squabbles of other commanders sometimes interfere with the effectiveness of various operations. But he owns that error at Cold Harbor, and I think that is the thing that his detractors seize on, so that in those low periods of his reputation, when he's called a drunk and a butcher, it's Cold Harbor that people really do have in mind. And it was a devastating and horrible battle.
All right, the last person I ever expected to read about in your book was Tallulah Bankhead.
Yes.
Who was she, and why did she make it to your book?
Well, Tallulah Bankhead is in the book for a couple of reasons. One was, I did mention the little foxes. There's an allusion to Sherman in the South in the Little Foxes, and it was yet another of those popular culture references to the Civil War in the 20th century that I wanted to bring in. But also, her grandfather was a Confederate veteran and a senator, and she was sometimes in Washington, I think, attending various festivities with him. And so he appeared, actually, and this is a sort of example, I think, of the kind of strangeness of the way that we have remembered that war, but appeared in his Confederate uniform on the floor of the Senate at the occasion of a reunion, and then marched down Pennsylvania Avenue, I believe, with a fellow senator who was in his Union uniform. And this was that sort of emblem of, that strange emblem of reconciliation. So I thought that was important to talk about and to think about the ways in which those figures who had served in the Confederacy made their way back into national life in various contexts.
His name was John Bankhead. He was a senator from Alabama. And it's, you quote in here, let's see if I can make sure I keep it straight, that in his 1920 memorial address for Bankhead Senator Henry Cabot Lodge of Massachusetts, the state of radical Republican Charles Sumner emphasized unity above all, and I just read a little bit of it. 2 years before his death, there was held here in Washington the 27th annual reunion of the Confederate veterans, and Senator Bankhead made on this floor a motion that the Senate adjourn over the day of their parade. I imagine that all who were present must recall the scene when Senator Bankhead dressed in a uniform of Confederate gray, simple as always, without notice and without parade, arose and addressed the Senate in support of his motion.
Yeah, I when you read it again, I'm amazed yet again that a senator could appear in his old Confederate uniform on the floor of the United States Senate. It's a remarkable moment, I think, in our history.
Later on, and shows you how big this book is on page 895. A $45 book? You have a John Russell Young reported Ulysses and Julia Grant's recollection of the day of the assassination. Here's some of the quotes. "The darkest day of my life," said the general, "was the day I heard of Lincoln's assassination. I did not know what it meant. Here was the rebellion put down in the field and starting up in the gutters. We had fought it as a war. Now we had to fight it as an assassination. He goes on, Mrs. Grant, while I was with the president, a note came from Mrs. Grant saying she must leave Washington that night. She wanted to go to Burlington to see our children. I was glad to have the note, as I did not want to go to the theater. He'd been invited to go to the theater with Lincoln. So I made my excuse to Lincoln, and at the proper hour, we started for the train. What else happened that night? Where did they go?
Yeah, so Grant Ulysses and Julia Grant were to go to, they had been invited to go to Ford's Theater that night with the president and Mrs. Lincoln. And I'm not sure that Julia Grant and Mary Lincoln got along all that well, but I think they really wanted to get back to Burlington, New Jersey, where their children were. And Grant, too, I think was happiest with his family and wanted to get back to them. So they ended up going straight home. But, of course, Grant had to turn right around and go back to Washington as soon as he learned of the assassination. So it was just sort of by chance that he was not there in the box.
As they were on their way to the train, this is the amazing thing about this footnote. As we were driving along Pennsylvania Avenue, the horseman drove past us on a gallop, and this is somebody that had been rude to them at a lunch. And back again around our carriage, looking into it, Mrs. Grant said, "There is the man who sat near us at lunch today with some other men and tried to overhear our conversation. He was so rude that we left the dining room." Turns out it was John Wilkes Booth.
Yeah, the conspirators were sort of, it was so mysterious, and I think that afterwards that they, I think they probably regarded themselves as quite fortunate to have escaped.
Later on, Walt Whitman comes into the picture. Why Walt Whitman?
Right.
That's part of your English and your...
Yes, so Walt Whitman, both in his poetry and drum taps and in his account of working as a volunteer nurse and tending to wounded soldiers, writes a great deal about the Civil War and writes a great deal about... One of the things that's interesting to me about Whitman is that he notes in the beginning the great enthusiasm for war, the volunteers marching off thinking it would sort of be a lark and wouldn't last very long, parading through the streets of Manhattan, and then, of course, the war turning into something very different. And then he also writes a lovely portrait of Grant in which he suggests that he is a sort of has some distinctively American virtues of a kind of modesty. Whitman seems to have it's a very affectionate portrait of Grant.
We're about out of time. Gary Cooper's in this, and movies are in it, and Frank Capra, and it goes on and on. Okay. If Grant was sitting here today, what's the one question you'd want to ask him first?
Oh, wow. Actually, and this will probably come as a surprise, I would want to hear more about something he alludes to only briefly there. And that's what I think of as the lost years. So it would be about those years, that time in the Pacific Northwest, where his letters reveal to Julia how miserable he is. But I would sort of want to hear more about how that period alone shaped his thinking about the Army and about war itself.
Our guest teaches English literature. Literature at West Point. Her name is Elizabeth D. Samet, and this is the annotated memoirs of Ulysses S. Grant. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Free transcripts, or to give us your comments about this program, visit us at Q&A programs are also available as C-SPAN podcasts.